Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After winning the primary in Florida, Republican presidential primary candidate Mitt Romney says he's looking forward to challenging Obama this fall. He talks about the Democratic Party as a whole in this clip.
They like to comfort themselves with the thought that a competitive campaign will leave us divided and weak. But I've got news for them. A competitive primary does not divide us, it prepares us, and we will win.
Joining us now to catch up on the Republican presidential primary, Chapter Infinity, is NPR's political editor, political junkie, Ken Rudin. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
So are the naysayers right? A competitive primary campaign in this case could split the party, or is Mitt Romney right that it'll strengthen it?
I think the answer is yes. Well, you know, we've seen both. Historically, we've seen both. We did see Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton battle all the way until June of 2008. And if anything, it made both candidates, especially Barack Obama, stronger, a better debater. And, of course, he had the issues on his side, and he went on to win in November. But there have been previous cases, Reagan versus Ford in 76, Carter versus Kennedy in 1980, those kind of battles for the nomination that go all the way to the convention, or at least up to the convention, don't always help the party.
And going forward, Newt Gingrich so far has said he's not backing down. So,
well, Newt Gingrich doesn't have that in his vocabulary, of course. As you know, there's been a bunch of endorsements. Today's Groundhog Day, which means we get Donald Trump for another 6 weeks, I think. But it's kind of interesting. But here's the thing. This is the first time I've used that joke. I'm going to save that for Talk of the Nation later
it's
today.
Very, very good.
Yes, okay. What's remarkable about it is that a week ago we were talking about how Newt Gingrich was on the ascendancy, that he had this great momentum coming out of South Carolina, right, where he won the primary by 12 points. He was good in the debates, and that all that momentum just crashed, you know, completely in Florida.
But did it, or are they just two such very different states?
Well, they are different states. Of course, South Carolina is much more conservative, more military-oriented. Florida is a much more expensive state with many media markets, that's MMMM, it's a tougher, and it's a much more moderate electorate. And, of course, it's also, more importantly, it's a winner-take-all primary. So unlike the previous states we've seen, there's no proportional representation of delegates. Romney won it, and he won it big, and he got all the delegates in Florida.
The exit poll showed that Newt did better among conservative Republican voters.
Very conservative.
These are all shades of gray at this point, aren't they?
Well, you know something? Once upon a time, the Republican Party was moderates and conservatives. Now the Republican Party is conservatives and very conservative. And it sounds like a joke, but it's true. The Republican Party no longer has those Rockefeller Republicans that once upon a time represented the Eastern establishment. There is an establishment in the Republican Party now, and it seems to be for Mitt Romney. But Romney is hardly a liberal as much as Newt Gingrich would like to convince us that he is.
Let's even it out and listen to Newt Gingrich. He lost to Romney by 14 points in Florida, even after his big win in South Carolina. As we said, he hasn't lost the drive, though, as he takes on President Barack Obama.
If Barack Obama gets reelected, it will be a disaster for the United States of America. Make no bones about it. If he can have a record this bad, unemployment this bad, deficits this bad, policies this bad, gasoline prices this high, and still get reelected, you can't imagine how radical he'll be in his second term.
Yeah, and some are saying Gingrich is radical, but in not a good way for Republicans.
Well, you know, so I don't think Gingrich's policies are that radical.
It's not his policies.
No, it's his personality, and it's Newt. I mean, Newt, you know, for all the complaints about Mitt Romney, and there are a lot of legitimate complaints, the inconsistency about health care, the inconsistency about a choice and, you know, gay rights and things like that, Newt Gingrich is a very imperfect messenger to bring that message, and that's the problem for the Republican Party. It's certainly a problem that Rick Santorum would love to capitalize on.
A columnist I read, I think it was this morning, said that neither Romney nor Gingrich are going to be good on the health care issue because both of them are on the wrong side of that, which means the same side, essentially, as Barack Obama.
Well, that's you know, I mean, first, yes, Newt Gingrich did support the public mandate, and yes, Mitt Romney did put his so-called Romney care when he was governor of Massachusetts. Romney, of course, will make the argument that what he's doing is not a federal mandate. It's a state-by-state, which is basically small government Republican philosophy as opposed to the Obama plan, which is nationwide. But look, there's going to be a lot of issues, a lot of things about the economy, and if people's jobs are at stake, you know, you could talk about moon colonies and health care and that all you want, but if the unemployment is steady, meaning not going down from the 8.7%, 9.7%, then that'll be the issue in November.
My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question for Ken, he's only going to be with us for a couple segments today. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, and you can tweet at @AnnFisherWOSU.org. And I didn't mean to sound too disappointed. We're happy for as much any time we can get with you, Ken Rudin.
Well, you were actually saying, do we have to do all 40 minutes? You were hoping for like 30 seconds.
So going forward, there's Nevada coming up this weekend, Maine, Colorado, Minnesota, Missouri, Michigan. What sort of month is ahead for Romney?
Well, it's much better for Mitt Romney and not so good for Newt Gingrich. First of all, he's always excelled in the debates. Now, he didn't do that great in the Florida debates, but debates gives him the opportunity to do his thing. There is no debate until February 22nd. That's in Arizona, and that's, you know, that's not good for Newt Gingrich. Also, the calendar, as you say, is very consequential, at least the month of February. Now, there is March 6th, Super Tuesday, when there's Georgia, Tennessee, Texas, southern states that Newt Gingrich could do well in. But what's coming up, you have Nevada on Saturday, which is a caucus, which Mitt Romney won in 2008. Next Tuesday, you have the main caucuses begin, the main caucuses begin on Saturday also, which Mitt Romney won 4 years ago. On Tuesday, you have Colorado and Minnesota, both of which Mitt Romney won in 2008. And so these are not big delegate states, but again, in a month where there'll be probably a dearth of big political news, any headline is a good headline, or any headline is a headline. And if Newt Gingrich can't win in those states, and I don't think he does, this could be a very good month for Mitt Romney. But you should also point out, that it could also be a good month for Ron Paul, who is strongly organizing in states like Maine, in Nevada, in Colorado. And whether he wins or not, he could win Maine, but he could pick up a bunch of delegates as well.
Washington Post wrote, I think, today about the strategic alliance between Mitt Romney and Ron Paul.
Well, I think what they mean is really that when Ron Paul basically has not been criticizing Mitt Romney the way Santorum and Gingrich have, and a matter of fact, Ron Paul has been really going after Newt Gingrich on many things. Because, look, you know, for all the argument about who is the true conservative, you can make the case that at least in terms of big government versus small government, Ron Paul has always been the candidate and the advocate of small government, and you cannot make that case about Newt Gingrich.
Nevada holds its caucuses on Saturday. Maine's week-long caucus begins as well. The states all do it so differently now.
They do. Maine is obviously the aberration of it all. To have it a week caucus, I mean, it's just that's
in such a small state.
It is a small state, and of course, no delegates will be apportioned, you know, for good until the state convention, which is months from now, and for all we know, the battle for the Republican nomination could be over by then. But again, it's not so much, even though you do need 1,144 delegates to win the nomination, it's really a story about momentum and headlines right now, not so much how few delegates are apportioned in Maine or Colorado or Minnesota. It's headlines, and that's the name of the game.
Now, when you're talking about the delegates aren't apportioned until the statewide convention, is that the way it works with caucuses?
Yes, it is. Actually,
okay.
Same with Iowa. I mean, we could talk about all the headlines, although this was a very botched Iowa caucus this year. Matter of fact, the Republican state chairman of Iowa resigned this week because of a bad, poor handling of it. And poor Rick Santorum. I mean, had we known the night of the January 3rd caucuses that Rick Santorum had won the caucuses, albeit by only 34 votes, that would have been a great momentum boost for him. Instead, we thought Romney won, then nobody won, and then weeks later, you know, a week or so later, Santorum got the nod as the winner, and he couldn't benefit from it. But anyway, but yes, these are just precinct caucuses. Then they go to county conventions where they elect delegates, and those delegates go to the state convention weeks or months later where they have the actual delegates that go to the national convention. And often by then, as I said, the battle for the nomination is over.
Yeah, I guess the caucuses are run by the parties.
The caucuses are run by the party.
Versus a primary election like in Ohio will be run by the boards of elections.
Right. And, yes, and of course, the state taxpayers pay for the primaries. Right. The party pays for the caucuses.
Hmm. Rick Santorum, irrelevant?
No, I don't think so. See, the argument for Rick Santorum has always been that Newt Gingrich is too irrational and too, one utterance away from self-destructing. And he says that because Newt Gingrich is just as imperfect about health care as Mitt Romney, and they belong linked together with Barack Obama, Rick Santorum should be the choice of conservative Republicans. The problem for Rick Santorum is that he doesn't have the money and he doesn't have the organization. Now, Newt Gingrich doesn't necessarily have much money, although he has some super PACs on his behalf. He doesn't have much money or organization either. But I guess if you look at South Carolina and if you look at Florida, it seems like, at least from those two states, the alternative to Mitt Romney, the anybody but Mitt candidate, could very well be Newt Gingrich. And if that's the case, then Santorum is out on his luck. And as for Ron Paul, Ron Paul is not going anywhere. He's going to stay in the race. He's already said, as Newt Gingrich has said, but you know it's true with Ron Paul, that he'll be there through the convention, getting his delegates, getting his proportion of the vote, and trying to make his case for his limited and small government philosophy.
It looks like, as you said before, that it's Mitt Romney's to lose in the next week, over the course of February. But how much does he have to win to shake off Newt Gingrich? Is there some kind of tipping point?
Well, if you want to go back to 2008 on the Democrats, after Iowa, after New Hampshire, after South Carolina, it was a very, very quiet February for the Democrats, but Barack Obama very cleverly and, he didn't have the microphone and the megaphone of the media, national media, but he was quietly picking up delegates in caucus states. Now, Hillary Clinton was not about to go away. She still had, the big state, the multi-big states of Ohio and Pennsylvania and North Carolina and all those states coming up, California, New York. But under the radar, Barack Obama was picking up delegates, and that's what Mitt Romney can clearly do in the month of February. But again, if Newt Gingrich still has enough money to make it through Super Tuesday, and I can't imagine him going away before that, once again, we could say the race is restarting because, as I say, states like Texas, Georgia, Tennessee, many of the states of Super Tuesday are in the South, and, at least on paper, those are great Newt Gingrich states.
Once again, my guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. We're looking for your calls, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'd love to hear from Republican-leaning members of our listenership right now and see what you think of the primary so far. 614, still fundraising, Ken. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. If you want, email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Freddie Mac bets billions against American homeowners. It's shocking. What should we learn here? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock on 89.7 NPR News. 39 degrees in downtown Columbus with cloudy skies. Expect mostly sunny skies today and a high near 50. Clear skies for tonight and a low of 30 degrees. More sunshine for Friday and a high of 52. And then a slight chance of rain Friday night, a low of 35 degrees. Looking ahead to the weekend, a slight chance of rain on Saturday, but still fairly warm though, a high of 45. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you mentioned it earlier, six more weeks of Donald Trump. What other sorts of endorsements might be out there for Newt Gingrich? Or is it going to just surprise you as much as anyone?
Well, I don't know what a surprise it was, but I mean, between Herman, I mean, look, the Tea Party, there's a difference. Different people see different things in Herman Cain and Donald Trump. I think I've made my views clear, but only not because of ideology, but sometimes I always felt that, you know, Donald Trump is a carnival act and not a serious person, but there are a lot of people who really thought that he would make a great nominee, that he would take it to President Obama. I mean, I don't know why that is, but anyway, so, I mean, there are some people like that who will endorse Newt Gingrich, but it's interesting, and people have pointed this out, too, that many of those who served in the House with Gingrich, very few of whom have endorsed him. That's the argument that a lot of Republicans are making. They're saying that, you know, the people who know him best, the people who served in the House with him, are just not on board. Now, I don't know how enthusiastic the folks for Mitt Romney are, because there are a lot of complaints about him, but maybe the feeling is that the longer this goes on, and this is part of the conversation we had in the beginning of the show, the longer this goes on, the worse it is for the Republican Party, the more, you know, aggressive Newt Gingrich will get, and the less will be the focus on defeating Obama in the fall.
Okay, now I'm just hearing that CNN just tweeted that Trump will endorse Romney.
Well, I heard on the radio this morning... I mean, I heard on the radio this morning that Trump is endorsing Gingrich.
Yeah, so did I. I heard Drudge Report was reporting it.
And now he's endorsing Romney.
Well, yeah, well, we don't know. Who knows? I mean, you know, it's the Donald. So.
I was watching, you know, Donald Trump was a big part of the big conversation on Face the Nation on Sunday on CBS, and Bob Schieffer had Dave Barry, the comedian, you know, the
humorous writer, yeah.
Humorous writer for the Miami Herald. And what better way to talk about Donald Trump than to have Dave Barry talk about it? But I don't know. I just don't see it. I mean, I might be forced to run. I know I don't want to do it, but I have to do it. He does this all the time, and then I roll my eyes. But often I see in the lamestream media, you know, how crazy, how seriously they take it, and I never understand it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the parallels between politics and theater. Sometimes.
True, and of course, people have been saying that since Ronald Reagan was elected. You know, and they say, "Wait a second, how can
literally
Ronald Reagan, an actor?"
Right.
But sometimes it just gets you. And given the problems that are out there, and given what's going on in the country with the unemployment, with the home foreclosures, with everything else that's going on, and to be, you know, focusing on a sideshow like Trump and the stuff that comes out of it, it's just that's the state of both politics. And perhaps journalism, too.
Newt Gingrich, does his chances or any possibility to be a running mate down the line, is that hurt or helped by hanging in there this long?
There's no way Newt Gingrich will be on a ticket. First of all, the thought of Newt Gingrich as a vice president, you know, second in charge.
Of anything.
No, it just would never happen. They don't like each other. Now, we've seen people who not especially like each other go together on a ticket. We saw Kennedy and Johnson. We saw Kerry and Edwards. We saw Reagan and Bush. I mean, it does happen, but not Romney and Newt Gingrich, and not anybody in Newt Gingrich, no.
I think it was in your blog you cited the notion of one Minnesota political scientist who said that the bandwagon effect, where voters are swayed by momentum, gathering in earlier voting states, may be weaker this year than usual.
Well, the only reason that may be the case is that the momentum just changes so rapidly. I mean, we did have just look at Newt Gingrich alone. For the longest time, Newt Gingrich was thought of as completely out of it. I mean, politically out of it. When his campaign resigned, his staff resigned in June and July, he was out doing a cruise with Calista. I mean, a lot of things were just not serious about it. And then he comes back, does great performances in the debates, suddenly becomes the front runner. After Herman Cain left the scene, he becomes the front runner. And then when Mitt Romney carpet bombed Gingrich in Iowa with tons and tons of negative ads, then Gingrich's numbers came down again. Then he wins in South Carolina. I've never seen in a battle for the nomination before was such an up and down. I mean, there have been momentums, different kinds of momentums for different candidates over the years, but sometimes we go from week to week where the whole dynamics changes.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's plenty of space for callers right now if you've ever wanted to talk to Ken Rudin.
That's a bad sign that nobody's calling.
No, well, the people have been calling, but they've been bringing up subjects we've already talked about or something like that. So they're calling. I can see them. But so try again.
I'm just so lonely. I just want someone to call.
Aren't I enough for you, Ken? Okay. I'm curious about all this, the primary process. Florida violated GOP rules by deciding to grant all its delegates to the statewide winner, all or nothing thing.
Right. They actually violated twice. They were not supposed to go before February. They wound up doing it January 31st, and they felt that the attention they would get was worth
violation
mm-hmm. that they would commit. So what happened was, instead of having 99 delegates, the RNC, the Republican National Committee, cut it in half to 50 delegates. Now, that's what happened to both Michigan and Florida in 2008 with the Democrats and the Republicans. And ultimately, there was some kind of deal at the convention to give them back to them. But they feel that, you know, what's the worst that could happen? Who cares if we have fewer delegates? We do have the attention, and certainly Florida had the attention for the better part of a week.
When that happens, and it says a decision that may be challenged regarding the violation, who would challenge it? Losing candidates?
Well, I don't know. No, actually, probably maybe Romney would challenge it, only because since it's a winner-take-all thing, maybe Romney could say that, you know, I want all 99 delegates and not 50. Or Gingrich could say, well, it shouldn't be winner-take-all. It should be proportional, and I should get, you know, 32% of the delegates. So, you know, anybody could challenge it. Ultimately, I think that, look, the irony of all this is that the Republican convention will take place in Florida, in Tampa, and yet here they are, the Florida. And it's not so much the Florida Republican Party that violated this. It's both parties. When the legislature in 2008 passed a bill to have an early primary, both Democrats and Republicans voted for it. So it's just in the desire to be first. And, you know, the way Iowa handled this thing with not knowing who won, first we thought it was Romney, then we didn't know, then it was Santorum. There's obviously going to be the typical pressure for Iowa to step out of the way in 2016, although we always talk about that and that never happens.
Mm-hmm. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. And Rick in Columbus.
Is it Rick Santorum? Or?
Rick, it's Rick in Columbus.
No,
I don't know if the last name's Santorum.
Not Santorum. 4 years ago, it was Obama and Clinton fighting close to the end. And there was, of course, the talk about how detrimental that might be to the Democratic candidate. Now we're talking about the same thing with the Republican candidates. And I wanted to know what the junkie thought about parallels there. And does it look like it's going to turn out well, like Romney says, that they're still debating?
Well, I mean, that's the issue. You really don't know it until this seems certainly much more personal than it was with Obama and Clinton in 2008. And as I said earlier in the show, it seems like, if anything, it made Obama a much better candidate, much better debater. I mean, everybody knew the potential of Obama, but we didn't see it realized until Hillary Clinton pushed him and pushed him and pushed him, you know, all the way up until June. But then again, you also have the case of Teddy Kennedy and Jimmy Carter in 1980, where Kennedy, clearly behind in the delegates, would not go away. And when you saw at the Madison Square Garden at the convention there in 1980, when, you know, you basically the look on Ted Kennedy's face when he had to embrace Jimmy Carter, it was painful to watch. And I think that, you know, that battle and that split in the Democratic Party showed all the way until November.
How about Reagan and
Ford in 76?
Yes.
Same thing. I mean, Ronald Reagan, if memory serves, Ronald Reagan lost the first five primaries there. He didn't win until North Carolina and then Florida, and then it was really a neck and neck through the convention. Reagan, you know, fought him all the way into the convention until the ballot, in the first ballot for the nomination. And Reagan, yes, he nominally campaigned for Gerald Ford in November, but the Republican Party, a lot of conservatives, were not thrilled about Ford, and they wound up, you know, he wound up losing to Jimmy Carter in November. So sometimes a battle can invigorate the candidates, or it could also sap the morale of the party. And right now, Romney versus Gingrich is very personal and very mean-spirited.
Yes. Yes, thank you.
Okay, Rick, thanks for the call. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We still have a few minutes to go. A political scientist from the University of Minnesota, I think you quoted him, he said he could be that Mitt Romney could be the first nominee to come out of the primary process in a long time where his unfavorable ratings are higher than his favorables.
Well, that's what's going on right now, and part of it is because of the battle, because of the battle for the Republican nomination has become so so personal and mean-spirited. But if you look at the polls, his number among independents, which is crucial for November, which Republicans are hoping to garner the support of independents against Obama, Mitt Romney's numbers among independents are really way, way down. I think it fell 18 points in the past couple of months. And obviously it's because of what's going on. One, it's what's going on in how ugly the primary is. And two, Mitt Romney having to move more and more to the right to show his conservative bona fides, it hurts him with independents. And, of course, you know, as Richard Nixon once said, you know, you run to the right to get the nomination, and then you move back to the center for the general election. The question is whether Mitt Romney could do it successfully.
We got an email from Blair asks that says that they're interested in your thoughts and ideas about campaign finance reform.
Well, lots of luck with that. I mean, there's a lot of talk about that. Obviously, the Citizens United Supreme Court decision in 2010 really opened up a ball of wax for all this money coming out, some of which we don't know where it's actually coming from. But, you know, for all the talk about President Obama and having a $1 billion campaign, well, you know, the Republican Party is not going to have any shortage of money either. There are a lot of these super PACs. By the way, it's corporations and labor. And just as, you know, the Karl Rove American Crossroads PAC will help Republicans, the SEIU and other labor unions will help Democrats. So it's not a one-sided thing. But having said that, there's tons and tons of money on the Republican side, a lot of it, as I said, unreported, that will, you know, if we're talking about how ugly Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and Florida were, and I was in Florida for a couple of days last week, and you could not turn on a TV without seeing a barrage of negative, I mean, it was unbelievable, one after another after another. I think it's going to be even worse in the fall.
Email from Debbie asks, any chance Ron Paul would be on the ticket as VP? Is it likely he would run as a third-party candidate?
Well, let's answer the two questions first. Regarding the second point, he has said he has no intention to do it. He is not planning to do it. Yes, he was a third-party candidate once before in 1988 when he was a candidate of the Libertarian Party. And then that would be after he left Congress and before he returned to Congress. There was a gap there. And so he says no, but he won't give an absolute no. And in fairness to him, why should he give an absolute no? I mean, he has no intention to do it. Now, for him on the ticket, he's going to be 77 years old. I mean, I'm not somebody who believes in ageism, and I know that just even saying that he's 77, it makes me susceptible to the charge that I'm talking about ageism. But he's not a vice presidential. I don't think he would ever want to be a vice president. I think he has a philosophy that is shared by many, not only in the Democratic or Republican Party, but Democrats too, certainly about the war and things like that. But I think it would marginalize him. I don't think he's not somebody who compromises. He, of all the candidates, he's not a compromiser in the sense that he doesn't compromise his own views. He's true to them. And I think by being a Democrat, by being a vice president, I think the middle name of the word vice president is compromise, and that's not Ron Paul.
Taylor in Columbus, you're on the air. You want to talk about Ron Paul?
I was curious. This is what Junkie thinks about Ron Paul being the only other candidate besides Mitt Romney actually poised to beat Obama in many polls.
That surprises me. I mean, there are a lot of polls that do show. I mean, look, obviously, Obama, who knows how, if the economy improves, if Obama's numbers improve in the fall, they seem to be steadily moving up. But a few months ago, not currently, but a few months ago, there were polls that showed Ron Paul also beating Obama. I don't think it could happen. I think for all the interesting thing that Ron Paul have to say about the wars, about the Fed policy, about foreign aid, about, you know, troops overseas, about ignoring what's at home and all those things, the Patriot Act, civil liberties, adherence to the Constitution. There are also some, you know, frankly, ideas that are out of the mainstream, you know, legalizing heroin, you know, things like that, that you know, the Democrats will just have a field day with. So the reason Ron Paul has such strong supporters is because he's true to his guns. You know, he sticks with it, and he has a lot, and his views on the war and the Fed and foreign policy is constant. But there are also some things in there, too, that I think would not make him a strong candidate in November.
Thanks, Taylor, for that call. Katie in Mansfield, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Katie.
Hi. I was just curious. I never heard follow-up from South Carolina as to whether or not Stephen Colbert's actions and his PAC had any effect on that race.
Well, you know, for all the talk about it, and it was kind of amusing, but first of all, South Carolina, it was too late for Stephen Colbert to get on the ballot there. Two, South Carolina primary does not allow a write-in candidate. So what Stephen Colbert said is that, okay, I want all my supporters to vote for Herman Cain. Now, I mean, that is kind of cute and funny and everything. And I think there were actually like 3,000 or 4,000 people who actually voted for Herman Cain. I think many of them – no, I was going to do a very bad joke. I just stopped myself in time, just in time for your show. But anyway, I think there was really not – ultimately, it was no effect. His goal, of course, is not to run for president or to be elected president of South Carolina, but to show the nuttiness of the campaign finance system, and he surely does that pretty effectively.
Thanks, Katie, for that call. And Ken in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Hi. I had a question. I've been impressed by some of the things that Mr. Romney has said about the president, his speeches calling him a socialist and other things. And I'm wondering if Romney really believes that, and how can he say it, because it's, you know, not true. And what effect do you think that kind of language will have in the general election?
Well, I don't think Romney ever called Obama a socialist. He did say that we have to stop these kind of policies that we see in Europe, which is obviously a reference to socialist policies, socialist governments in Europe. I don't think he's called him a socialist as much as Gingrich has called him that. But he has said pretty negative things. But, you know, I mean, the real question is, who is the true Mitt Romney? And I've said this before, when he ran for the Senate against Ted Kennedy in 1994, when he ran for governor of Massachusetts in 2002, he was nominally pro-choice. He was not a pro-life candidate. Now, he did say that he evolved as governor. Some will say that he evolved because he wanted to be president of a conservative party. But regardless, the problem with Mitt Romney, even though I think he is the most electable Republican against President Obama, there are still conservatives, many conservatives, who just feel that they don't trust him. They don't know if he really believes in what he says. And, you know, it's one thing that Newt Gingrich may believe what he says, but he may be just too angry to win. Romney, by maybe that fuzziness is to his benefit. But if he's going to get a united party behind him, if he's going to have an enthusiastic Republican turnout, he's going to have to convince Republicans that what he's saying he believes in.
Ken Rudin, thanks as always for your time today.
And it was my pleasure.
Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the Super Bowl. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Join Kappa, WOSU, and Capital Crossroads SID for a special screening of Columbus Neighborhoods, Franklinton Downtown, at the Ohio Theater on Tuesday, February 14th. The program begins with the Ohio Mighty Morgan organ pre-show at 11:30 a.m. Pre-sale tickets include a fresh box lunch and the chance to win tickets to the Broadway series production of Memphis. For tickets to the screening, call Kappa at 614-469-0939 or visit columbusneighborhoods.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides begins with a discussion of Latinas in Ohio, immigration and labor issues for women in Ohio and nationally. And also in the hour, a preview of Columbus's bicentennial celebrations. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher from 11 till noon. And for the latest from the WOSU Newsroom, be sure to follow WOSU News on Twitter or like the station on Facebook. And be sure to sign up for our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Just visit WOSU.org/email to register. 39 degrees with a few clouds. Expect sunshine today and a high near 50 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 30. Mostly sunny skies for Friday and a high of 52. There's a slight chance of rain Friday night and a low of 35 degrees. Expect a little rain on Saturday and a high of 45. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We've been wondering, what does it take to put on a Super Bowl, especially in a city very similar to Columbus in size and other sorts of values, and especially since we're going to get the All-Star game for hockey next year. Chris Gall has traveled to three Super Bowls on behalf of Indianapolis to help prepare that city for its own Super Bowl extravaganza, its very first Super Bowl. He is Vice President of Marketing and Communications for the Indianapolis Convention and Visitors Association. He joins us now by telephone from Indianapolis, I assume. Welcome, Chris.
Well, Ann, thanks for having me on the program. And yes, from the epicenter of all things sports and I guess kind of America's unofficial holiday, the Super Bowl, where we're teaming with more than 150,000 people from around the globe descending here to enjoy the big game on Sunday.
So that's not a bad gig. You get to go to three Super Bowls with all the fixins, no doubt. It's not like you're getting the crummy seats or anything to prepare for your own. What did you learn out there over the last 3 years that helped you the most to prepare for this one?
Well, sure. As a cold weather destination, we're not hiding behind the fact that there might be some elements. And so traveling to Miami twice and then Dallas last year, Dallas was paralyzed by that ice storm. So we really we looked, would you believe, we cracked open the Farmer's Almanac, and we found over the last 30 years 13 weather patterns that have occurred on the first weekend in February. And we have a contingency plan for each of those 13, including a tornado. And so from a weather standpoint, we really learned and have put systems in place to roll with the punches. But I can tell you, Ann, it's looking to be 42 and partly cloudy on Super Bowl Sunday. So it looks like we're going to be in the clear.
Dream weather.
Dream weather for sure.
For Indiana in the middle of the winter.
Absolutely.
There's a big new Marriott in Indianapolis. Someone was telling me about it last night. And I was wondering, was getting the Super Bowl contingent on building more guest rooms and getting that a structure like that Marriott in place in time?
It's a great question. The world's largest JW Marriott is here in Indianapolis. It's 1,000 rooms plus. That was a crucial part of our package to be able to offer to the NFL to even be in running in contingency for hosting a Super Bowl was a 1,000-room true convention headquarter, event headquarter hotel. And what's nice is that hotel was already in the works based on supply and demand from a tourism perspective before we tossed our hat in to bid and host the Super Bowl for 2012 this year. But certainly an integral part of the bid was having a stadium with at least 70,000 seats and being able to have a convention center with at least 500,000 square feet of contiguous exhibit space and then this 1,000-room convention headquarter hotel. So a lot of infrastructure that had to be in place, and then certainly with a proven track record of hosting the world's largest single-day sporting event each year, the Indianapolis 500,
right.
The NFL was confident in the city's ability to rally the troops and collectively roll out the red carpet for this event.
Now, the Chicago Tribune was writing about that and said that the Indianapolis 500 attracts more than 200,000 fans each year, and you were talking about 150,000 people coming in. What's the difference?
Yeah, sure. So the
besides 50,000, of course.
It's really, you know, when we look at the Indianapolis 500, and I should mention the Indy 500 generates $336 million in economic impact each year. And the Indianapolis Super Bowl is slated to generate $150 million in economic impact. So essentially, we host a Super Bowl times two every year when we have the Indy 500 mm-hmm. in town. So economically, it's big bucks for the city. And, again, just being able to have the infrastructure and the hotels and the restaurants downtown for many of your visitors. And we have long admired Columbus. We are very like-minded, charming, family-friendly cities with arts and cultural amenities galore. And for many of your visitors who have listeners who have come as visitors to Indianapolis, you know, you park your car and you walk and you don't need to see it again until you leave. And that's some of the same things we've created downtown Indianapolis as we've transformed it into a Super Bowl village.
Okay, so the Tribune also brought up the fact that despite the Indy 500, despite the having hosted the NCAA's Men's Final Four basketball tournament six times since 1980, the Super Bowl and the first Super Bowl there poses some unique challenges. What are those unique challenges?
Well, you know, with any Super Bowl host city that's cold weathered, I think there's, you know, 65% of those people coming on the ground and are corporate decision makers, they're business executives, and they're used to going to a city that offers ocean or golf and a warm climate because it's a getaway of sorts. It's corporate entertaining at its finest. And so we were charged via the NFL to, without ocean, without mountains, without golf courses, to create an atmosphere that a corporate decision maker would enjoy. And so essentially we've got a three-block plaza of our downtown that's modeled after a plaza in Barcelona, Spain. We've transformed that into Olympic-style village, a Super Bowl village. And without mountains or ocean or golf courses, we're making it a very fan-festive environment with warming stations and a zip line even high above the action, lots of free concerts. We've turned up the heat on the number of private parties and fundraisers and community-related events to make sure that the corporate community sees that even though we don't have 80-degree weather, we have a lot going on from a hospitality standpoint.
My guest is Chris Gall. He is Vice President of Marketing and Communications for the Indianapolis Convention and Visitors Association. We're talking about the 2012 Super Bowl that will be held there this weekend. If you have any questions or comments for Chris, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What sort of security threats are there? And I'm sure you're not going to give me any of your plans, but is Indianapolis better or better prepared or in a better position or less prepared in a less favorable position?
Great question, Ann. We learned very quickly that the Super Bowl is considered a SEER 1 security event. That's a special event assessment rating. And this is a security measure, a SEER 1 event that's if you host the Olympics, if you host the Super Bowl, if you have the Pope visit, or a presidential visit. One of those four are reserved as a SEER 1 event. And so from a security standpoint, the FBI, state troopers, and then local authorities have all worked collectively, along with some private security, to ensure that boundaries are set, safe zones are created, and you have never seen a more fluid yet very methodical system of checkpoints and getting people in and out based on this Tier 1 rating that the Super Bowl has given. And so we are very prepared, very buttoned up, and again, the close proximity of our downtown is conducive for major events, and it's easily set up to have safe zones and places to be checked and to go through. But it was interesting to learn about this Tier 1 rating and what it meant and what we had to provide as a community to make sure everyone is safe.
When you're talking about the $150 million in economic impact, how much of that is lost to spending on the Super Bowl, spending on the security issues, you know, putting the village together? That, is that a net or is that a gross?
That's a that is a net. Actually, okay. The $25 million was raised privately through private companies and corporate giving, and that was what we had to have in hand to put on the Indianapolis Super Bowl. And that's because a lot of the infrastructure was already coming online, and the $25 million, to your point, Ann, and a good one, a big chunk of that will go towards paying for security. A big chunk of that will go for some advertising requirements that we have to have in place as a city to promote the ancillary events surrounding the Super Bowl. And another big chunk of that goes to dressing up the city from a signage and inside the Indiana Convention Center with the NFL Experience, which is a football theme park. A lot of infrastructure and some signage put in place inside that facility. So a big chunk of that went to that. And then certainly we have 28 full-time paid staff that have been planning this for the last 4 years, and they're part of that $25 million in terms of their salary and benefits.
And does the NFL pitch in money?
The NFL does. The NFL does pitch in. This is their biggest event of the year, and so there are things and parties and certain concessions that they make through our contract with them that that are in place. And they're I can't tell you how good of a partner they are, and very transparent and very easy to work with. And I think that might come as a surprise when you look at the enormity of this event with 110 million eyes tuning in Sunday. The most watched television event of the year and has been for the last decade. And I can't tell you how incredibly easy it is to work with them in true transparency.
You mentioned earlier that what an incredible venue this has to be, because it's an entertainment venue for hundreds of thousands of men from around the country and around the world. There's been a lot of publicity lately about human trafficking at these large sporting events.
Sure.
What is the city doing to address that challenge?
It's a great question, and unfortunately, in recent years, the Super Bowl has been lit up with this human and sex trafficking, and I can tell you for 3 years now, we've had regularly occurring meetings with law enforcement officials. There's a separate committee here in Indianapolis of about 100 people who are designated to nothing else but getting behind it, ensuring it doesn't happen, and it, in the case it will or does, to mitigate that to swiftly bring those people to justice. And so it's been interesting as this issue has been coming and growing, how we have proactively had to and willingly wanted to work with the NFL to make sure we nip this in the bud. But certainly, to your point, in previous years, it's been a mounting issue.
Is there public service announcements, any kind of advertising or education being done?
Absolutely. Here locally in Indianapolis, through official law enforcement channels, both in paid media and some community services, and our public safety officials have been really pounding the pavement to educate, and here are the things you need to look out for in the case that you run into this.
In a lot of big events these days, there's some attention paid to the folks who not only can't afford it, but are very down given the economic downturn.
Yeah.
What kind of relationship does the event have with the need in the community?
Well, we have pledged that this will be more than a game. We have created a lasting footprint in unison with the NFL, and there's a part of our downtown, the Near East Side, that has fallen into dilapidation. They were a drug-infested part of our community, and kids were not going to school. And we have invested about $13 million through grants and corporate fundraising into a Near East Side Legacy Project. And there's a community center that's at the focal point of this, and the community center is where kids can get off the street and go learn and polish their resume and do after-school health clinics. It's getting kids off the street into these programs. There's been urban renewal with community gardening, new infrastructure, more than 400 new homes built or rehabbed over a three-year period. And the NFL has been enamored with our legacy project, so much so that they are mandating that future Super Bowl host cities attempt to emulate what we're doing here in Indianapolis to make sure it's more than a game, and that there's a lasting footprint and a positive one that's put in place. So we've planted more than 2012 trees in honor of the 2012 Super Bowl, and it's just cool to see how everything has evolved.
I know there was a press conference scheduled at 10 a.m. this morning regarding counterfeit Super Bowl merchandise and tickets.
It's something that happens every year. And having attended a couple of these Super Bowls, I can tell you it's there are at least seven parts of your Super Bowl ticket that are checked before you go into the NFL arena, in our case, Lucas Oil Stadium. They take painstakingly drastic measures to make sure that tickets can't be counterfeited. And I've personally stood in line, and I've entered a Super Bowl where people surrounding me have not been able to get in because they bought tickets off the street that were counterfeit. That's an expensive mistake. And so with these security measures in place, we really just want to educate those who might be considering buying a ticket, not through an official broker or the NFL ticket exchange, to watch out for these, because certainly in every past Super Bowl, this is what happens.
Is there anywhere people can go to double check that their ticket is legitimate?
If you go online to the NFL Ticket Exchange, a quick Google search would provide that web link. You can see the seven or even eight points of interest that you want to check if you're getting a ticket. And really, they want you to go through the NFL Ticket Exchange. You'll see that prices are cheaper and they're legitimate tickets, so it's a win-win for everyone.
You know, I mentioned at the top that Columbus is getting the NHL All-Star Game next year, and people are excited about that. That's a big deal, and it's no Super Bowl. But what kind of advice would you give the planners here in Columbus as they look forward to that?
To coming in just as a whole?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, you know,
yeah, to plan for something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. It's making sure that the community is behind and that the consensus has been built. And, you know, you guys have done incredible strides, as we have as a city, and here tucked away in the Midwest to make sure that we put stereotypes aside. You know, we were very methodical in building all of this $3 billion in new tourism-related infrastructure and stadium and convention center that the community was behind it, and that they knew that the benefit would be not only a Super Bowl but future convention business and other special events. And so it was really a grassroots campaign to build that community support, and we just feel extremely blessed to be able to host America's Holiday and shine the international spotlight on Indianapolis.
Chris Gall, thanks for joining us today.
And I'm honored to be on your program. I love your city. I really do. And I appreciate you having me on.
Well, we appreciate that on the eve of our 200th birthday in Columbus. So thank you very much.
I have friends and family there. I'll come see you soon.
All right, great. Chris Gall, he's Vice President of Marketing and Communications for the Indianapolis Convention and Visitors Association. He'll be watching the Super Bowl this weekend along with millions. How many did he say? How many millions? 110 million sets of eyes. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.